This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome, dear listeners. Welcome to the third episode of the UPP mini-series on cities and geopolitics that we're producing in collaboration with the Second Cold War Observatory and Urban Geography Journal. In the last episode, we had a spirited conversation with Emily Conrad, Simon Marwin, and Justin Koller on infrastructures of power. In the war-ridden global landscape at the moment, we're seeing a major resuturing of corridors, logistics, and supply chains, and also circulation, which is manifesting in all kinds of everyday implications for us, such as closure of transit routes. I have friends who cannot plan. They have a fear of flying because they don't want to be stuck in a place. We don't have so much certainty to plan these kind of things anymore. There's increase of prices in all kinds of commodities that we're seeing at the moment. How does this sort of refer to corridors, logistics, and circulation, and what's the geopolitics of it at the current conjuncture? So this is going to be a puzzle that we'll try to explore in this podcast. So in this episode, we'll be exploring this crucial aspect of cities and geopolitics through the topic of corridors, logistics, and circulation. So as you may recall, in the opening episode, Seth Schindler and Kevin Ward alluded to the notion of how extended urbanization unfolds beyond cities through corridors, logistics, and circulation, and how that is a defining condition of the current geopolitical urbanization that we're seeing, and how that is different than, let's say, the geopolitical urbanization that happened in the First Cold War. To help explore this puzzle further and help us better understand this very complicated dynamic, we have three excellent guests with us today whose work focuses on geopolitics of corridors, logistics, and circulation. So our first guest today is Professor John Silver. He's the Deputy Director at the Urban Institute at the University of Sheffield, where he's currently leading a ERC-funded project called Global Corridor, which investigates the role of new infrastructure corridors in shaping the urbanization processes and inequality through comparative investigations. His work has taken him to a range of cities across global norths and global souths, working on post-colonial modes of theorizing, paying attention to the ways in which finance, urban politics, everyday interactions, and visions of futurity come to shape the infrastructure terrain. Our second guest today, Dr. Jasnia Sarma, originally from Assam in Northeast India, is a feminist geographer and ethnographer researching borderlands and frontiers, and is currently based in Switzerland and is actually one of my neighbors and colleagues here at the University of Zurich. She works here at the University of Zurich as a senior lecturer in political geography and critical geopolitics. She's an editor of the journal Geopolitics and has previously edited the independent blog on Burma/Myanmar studies, the Anti-Circle. Our third guest, Dr. Luis Pizuzo, is an early career scholar who holds a joint PhD in policy management, development, and urban planning from the University of Manchester and Melbourne. His research focuses on development of Mombasa Port in Kenya and examines how its ongoing redevelopment intersects with various geopolitical agendas and domestic political realities, while foregrounding urban and socio-environmental implications of the port's development in Mombasa. So welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us today. Before passing on the mic to you, I would like to pose the question, what is geopolitical significance of corridors and logistics infrastructures? And if I may add to that question, what is geopolitical about them and what is urban about them? Let's start with you, John, as you've been working on this question much longer than any of us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show. In sum, corridors can help us read the geopolitical future. Thinking from Mbale in eastern Uganda at the top end of the Northern Corridor, one sees a changing urban situation in which the post-colonial malaise and the structural adjustment programs of the 1980s and 1990s now give way to new forms of Chinese investment, construction expertise in railways, special economic zones, and such forth. So here we see a town that is very much being re-urbanized, being re-industrialized, but under very different geopolitical relations and conditions, ones that require disentangling and thinking about in a world in which we increasingly see a weaponized global economy playing out through who controls not just the hotspots of the global economy, nor the extractive resources and hinterlands of copper or lithium or carbon, but in the infrastructures of circulation, which allow these resources and finances to flow through corridor delineations. I think the war in and on Iran by the US and Israel really brings this to public attention. We see how both the weaponization of the global economy and the capacity to control choke points and corridors plays out as a not just an economic war, but as a military war now. And waking up every morning, the first thing I hear on the news is normally a new proposal for a Middle Eastern corridor that allows some kind of bypass outside of this blockade or outside of the US blockade, of the Iranian blockade. And this is really an intensification, but also an acceleration of what we've been seeing since the 2008 economic crisis, emerging not just out of the Chinese-led Belt and Road Initiative, but also a range of geopolitical actors involved in various kinds of corridor plans. The Lobutu corridor in Angola has become another contested corridor between initial Chinese investment in railways and ports over the last 20 years and attempts by the US to gain some kind of foothold through investments in the railway and in various other kinds of infrastructures and resources. But to condense it down to China and the US as a competition would, I think, be wrong. There are other significant geopolitical actors involved in these corridors. We see the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, particularly the UAE and Saudi, involved in all kinds of investments in the Horn of Africa and elsewhere. And if corridors become the new infrastructure of power, then the competition over them is becoming increasingly heated. This, of course, has serious urban implications. Towns and cities, some more significant, some less significant, perhaps, such as Mbali, are being transformed, but are also integral to the ways in which these corridor geographies unfold. I think it's probably straightforward now for members of the public, as well as scholars, to see the geopolitics in corridors. But it is important to emphasize the urban dimensions of these corridors. Firstly, because most large-scale infrastructure corridors are predicated on nodes such as Mombasa Port or capital cities, but also because they run through these towns and cities, shaping urban experience and urban lives. If we think of corridors as the infrastructure of extended urbanization, the networks that mesh together operational landscapes and the city, then we can see how they are both urban and geopolitical and integral to the urban futures being shaped here and now.
Thanks, John. Jasnia, do you want to go next, maybe?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that, Jonathan. That was really interesting in terms of you've given us this very big picture analysis of how corridors and logistics infrastructures are connected with this moment. Indeed, we are living in the moment of Hormuz, which is a deeply geopolitical moment. And not only that, but it was happening on the 10th day of Ramadan, on the 20th of February. This is the moment of Hormuz, but before times there was the moment of Panama. There was the moment of the Suez Canal with the nationalization of it, with Malacca Straits, from which 88% of world trade goes through. You had other nodes and choke points and corridors Of course, it's a geopolitical obsession, but the question that really could be connected with what's happening on now, as well as what was happening previously in even the conceptualization of geopolitics, even as a field, you go back to the Swedish conservative geopolitician, the first person who ever used this word geopolitics, Rudolf Schellion, who was a pupil of Friedrich Ratzal from the German highly colonial imperial field. And then you had, of course, Curzon, Mackinder, all of the imperial geopolitical thinkers had very imperial and masculinist ways of thinking about whoever, you know, controls the heartland would control the, you know, the future, the geographical pivot to history. So much of geopolitical corridors functions as a process of who controls them, at whose expense, at what expense, and also how processes of colonialism, coloniality configures not only in the past, but also very much to the present. We see that with the example that was given just now of the Lobito corridor. But that brings us to another question, is that who are the players of this geopolitics? Because of course, oftentimes we think about, you know, states, colonial powers, imperial powers as the only players in this idea of who controls corridors and so on. When we think about airports, the Heathrow Airport, it's one of the largest airports in the world. It's controlled by sovereign wealth funds, controlled by Qatar and Saudi Arabia, pension funds. And now you have financial actors, private equity actors, you have investment asset holders like BlackRock, who invest in certain not very favorable things like fossil fuels, and you've got weapons and all of that. They are the ones who are trying to buy off certain ports in the Panama Canal, right? And that, again, is going to be another competition between what China already holds. It's the Li Ka-shing Hong Kong-based company that holds those ports. And now this is a contestation. Again, the who are the players of this geopolitics? Who controls all of what we call logistics? And of course, you've got states, you've got financial stakeholders, but then you've also got the people that these infrastructures are supposed to border, order, mobilize, control. And that's, for me, also an important player in thinking about the actors of who really become imbricated in this politics of corridors and mobility. And later on, we can talk a little bit more about, you know, where I work in across India, China and Burma, which is, you know, historically been a chokehold, a corridor. In fact, the place that I come from, Northeast India, some of you might know, maybe the listeners know about this, but it's cutely called, after all, a chicken's neck, which is a 20-kilometer kind of logistical road that could be, according to the Indian state's territorial sovereign anxieties and imaginations, could be snapped anytime, much like a chicken, you know, because it's kind of surrounded by different countries, which of course is a product of partitions, several partitions, the creation of Bangladesh, and today operates as one of the most securitized channels that control and order these societies that live within these areas. So in a nutshell, what's geopolitical about corridors and logistics is obviously the big geopolitics of competition, of resources, finances, a precarious labor, which is important to talk about, but also the actors within who are implicated within these corridors, who often disrupt, as we know, in the case of many zones which are under war right now, and then you also have disruptions going on. So infrastructure, again, can be assembled and manipulated to be again, disrupted by not only the actors who are supposed to be, you know, controlling them, but also those over and through which infrastructures and logistics pass. The urban question, absolutely, whoever controls mobility resources controls the conditions of life. And life is, after all, absolutely at the heart of urban societies. Who really is able to access resources, titles, land, finances across spaces that are being reconfigured as logistical corridors, which are being reconfigured as parts of smart city development, gateway city developments, as part of these logistical creations? Who then belongs in the urban space in terms of how these corridors and logistics are reframing and refurbishing financial and real estate development in urban areas? So those are the big sort of questions that we can talk about through cases. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah. Luis, maybe do you want to come in?
Yeah, of course, as well. Very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I think John and Jasnia have kind of very well kind of given this, you know, kind of complete picture of the geopolitical states involved in corridors and logistics. And maybe I'd like to, you know, come in a kind of complementary way by approaching it through the kind of discussions that we've been having, you know, at the Second Cold War Observatory about this idea that what is increasingly characterizing geopolitical rivalry is this form of network-based competition, right? So increasingly, you know, actors such as, you know, the United States, China, but also others are focused on competing over very integrated, you know, transnational production and exchange networks. And I think what this means for the significance of corridor and logistics is that I think they are particularly central, you know, in this process, and they, you know, raise, you know, a bunch of questions that Jasnia has also mentioned about who gets to define how commodities circulate, who gets to capture value, and who gets to define how, you know, supply chains are secured, right? I'll also, you know, just, you know, kind of add on the reflections that John and Jasnia have had about the Hormuz Strait. And I mean, I think it's, you know, very obvious that what it reveals is that it's not just about, you know, military capacity and, you know, having the greatest army of the world. You know, you can have, you know, a power that is Iran, that which is in many respects is less, you know, potent militarily and in other respects, but has managed to, you know, from the get-go, really, you know, since this conflict has started, to just block the right bottleneck and to stop, you know, oil from circulating. And we are seeing the kind of, you know, economic consequences and geopolitical consequences is having for the United States, etc. But also when we think from the perspective of the global South, and especially from my case, from the African context, it's also how it reveals this kind of persisting structural inequalities in terms of who is the most, you know, negatively impacted by these dynamics of geopolitical contestation. And I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, a number of countries that are starting to run through issues of oil shortage. And another issue that is, you know, maybe a bit less discussed is the question of fertilizers. You have a number of countries in East Africa which are dependent on fertilizers from the GCC, and including, you know, Kenya and others. It's also, I guess, what it tells about persisting inequalities, global inequalities, structural inequalities, and how they are revealed by these kinds of geopolitical contestations around critical choke points of global circulation. And about the urban question, so in my case, my interest is in the city of Mombasa and the kind of, you know, contestation that have been taking place between different actors, and how the position of the city, at least conceived as a nodal city, whether it is, you know, China and it's, you know, approaching through its perspective of the BRI, through, you know, what has been extensively discussed, which is the SGR railway. On the other hand, you also have other actors that are less discussed, that are quite active in the city. For instance, Japan, through its that has, you know, come to frame the project that it is developing in the port of Mombasa, around its free and open Indo-Pacific framework. So you have these kind of rival connectivity strategies that are overlapping in this city that is conceived as a nodal city, but it's also, of course, always a city where people live, where people try to make a living, sometimes in, you know, conditions of informality. So I think it's also important to ask the question again, I think Jasnia mentioned it, about, it's not just about, you know, these big rivalries about, you know, between superpowers. It's also about how everyday people find ways to navigate these situations. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Lewis. I think that's a really great segue into my next question, which is, how do these circulation systems reshape urban and regional geographies? So I would love if you could use the examples of places that you're working with to maybe explain to our listeners, how are these places transforming, really? Like, so maybe we could go in the same order. John, do you want to pick up first?
Great question. And like a good infrastructure scholar, I will revisit splintering urbanism, because I think the seeds of the answer very much lay in that landmark text. What we see is the requirements of global infrastructure projects nearly always taking paramount importance over local populations, whatever the scheme, whatever the project, whoever the funder, whatever the geopolitics behind it. This inequality shaped through infrastructure has been really vivid in the Global Corridor project and the range of sites that we've been investigating alongside partners. In Karachi, another Pakistani city is Tawheed Mohammed of the Karachi Urban Lab, and I have been looking at how the standards required for the new ML1 train line upgrade have significant implications for local populations. The clearance of the railway either side between 20 and 40 metres means the distance really shapes thousands of people's future urban lives. And if the kind of broader delineation is required, 12,000-15,000 households will be forced to move. In Karachi, this is significant to move from the centre or near the centre of the city to somewhere on the edges. You lose your livelihood, you lose your social connections, and that kind of age-old story of dispossession and displacement is reanimated. Atufa Samo has been doing similar but very different work in the Thar desert towns of Mithi and Islamabad, where a Chinese coal-fired power station and coal mine have been invested and implemented. Their villagers have lost their entire villages and their ways of life. In Nairobi, the building of the expressway, researched by Wairimu Gathimba on the project, saw up to 40,000 people demolished out of their homes. And so we can see this age-old story of splintering urbanism. We can see this age-old story of these national economic development projects taking precedent over everyday intricate urban lives and inhabitations. And I think that that should always be at the forefront of thinking about how urban regional geography and space is being reshaped. But there's other kinds of stories that emerge when we think about corridors and the way in which these circulation systems engage with urban space. And I think one interesting thing that's come out of the project is how a number of urban settlements are kind of shifting from industrial to logistical use, and the kind of spatial demands and livelihoods and labour that go alongside that. In Athens, working with Yanis Kalionis and Harakuki, we see how the post-industrial landscape of the Athens metropolitan region, particularly in the bay over from the main city in Elefsina and Aspropyrgos, is increasingly moving from a classical industrial landscape to one that is around logistics and circulation. So there are less factories, there's more warehouses, there's investments in new pipelines, in ship repair yards, and in new kind of multimodal initiatives. In Duisburg, a powerful industrial city in Germany, the entry of the Chinese railway into the city precipitated a whole kind of shift to Germany's China City, as the city municipal officials called Duisburg for a while. And again, you're seeing this very, very dramatic shift from a kind of industrial usage to one of a logistical usage. And I think we're seeing how these operational landscapes that previously existed outside of cities are increasingly being incorporated into these urban spaces. This, of course, comes with lots of different urban political implications in these geographies. Do logistical sector labourers have the same kind of labour power as industrial workers? Do the residents sitting along a railway line in Pakistan or an expressway in Kenya have the kind of power to resist these massive projects? So I think they're the two main ways in which we've tried to look at urban and regional geographies in this project. The kind of final thing that I would like to add is that not far behind the logistics of circulation and the reshaping of urban and regional geographies come new kind of real estate frontiers. Connectivity brings opportunity, It brings real estate agents, it brings developers, it brings national and international real estate, rent-seeking finance. And we can see how, for instance, the port in Gwadar, an integral part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, is only part of the story. So from the outside, Gwadar is very much a corridor city, but it's also a place of real estate opportunity, speculation, a massive surge of finance into various kind of estates, and the speculation of Pakistanis and others in Gwadar as a not just a logistical city, but also as a real estate frontier. So yeah, let's never forget that there's always a real estate developer or agent sat behind any kind of large-scale infrastructure plan.
Thanks, John, for that. Jasnir, would you like to go in next?
Thank you, Nitin. The question of circulation systems and reshaping urban and regional geographies. I think Jonathan has given us a really big kind of world tour, you know, we go through. And I'm going to pick up a couple of, you know, a couple of points from Jonathan's kind of answer there, which is about, you know, frontiers, infrastructural frontiers, a corridor is a frontier. Oftentimes, the workplaces that I work in are in borderlands. And oftentimes, it's not very surprising that borderlands or border spaces are, in fact, exactly at the center of where corridors pass through. And this can be seen at a global scale altogether because, you know, corridors don't just go to places, they go through them. And so that throughness is always this in-betweenness, this liminality of place that it reaches through. And I can tell you a little bit from experience, but also through some of my research that I've done across the border cities, you know, which are not only in China, you know, with Myanmar and on the northern side of it, but also Northeast India and Myanmar. So this is actually, if you look at the map, these seem like three different countries, but if you really look at it, and if you would look at it from a colonial mindset, you see it as a connected region. And it was, in fact, a very, very connected region, you know, before you had colonial borders here. The city that I grew up in is called Guwahati. When I was growing up there in the 80s and the 90s, oftentimes the things that you would see are, you know, I thought it was very natural and normal that when you go out of your house, you see people in military uniforms. And I thought this is just the way the entire world lives, you know, and because I didn't quite realize that actually where I was had been essentially a militarized city. And of course, when you don't know the rest of the world, you think the militarized city is the way the world works. But it was only after the 90s and the, you know, 2000s that you see massive, massive changes in the city. One of the things that happened as part of this city being a militarized city was that you had a lot of untouched nature. So it was the wetlands reserved, you had a lot of urban ecologies, every house came with a garden, you know, and the residential areas had a lot of trees. And today, fast forward, you know, 30, 38 years, that's no longer the case. So what's changed? I'm not going to go very deep dive into the history, but Northeast India and Guwahati, this is actually a gateway city that has been imagined as a corridor city, that has been imagined as a place that is finally going to connect, you know, the rest of quote unquote mainland India with, you know, markets, resources, labor, and ecologies to Southeast Asia. So this is the major city. And from there, you have other hill cities that are surrounding it. And all of these areas have been kind of refurbished and rethought as corridor cities through something called the Act East policy that was originally called the Look East policy, because India suddenly realized, you know, oh, we haven't really looked at the East. Now it's time to look East, and not only look East, but also act East. Similar things have happened all across China. You know, you have Chinese, Yunnanese businessmen who were going into Burma for its massive timber logging jade economies. You had, and then opium economies. And now you have agribusiness plantations. You have rare earths minerals, some of the largest amounts of rare earths that are coming into the China, which is the largest importer and exporter of rare earth minerals, comes from Myanmar. And so you had cities that were growing up, corridors, along these corridors of extraction. How does this kind of reshape urban and regional geographies? Today, if you look at Guwahati and its surrounding areas in Bornihat, it has become one of the world's most polluted urban metropolitan areas. And this pollution is not accidental. this pollution comes as its frontierization process starts to create forms of urban ecological destruction. The loss of water bodies has magnified beyond anybody has ever imagined. You have AQI levels that are beyond sometimes what's also in cities like Delhi and so on. And on top of that, you have the emergence of land mafia, which is part of the speculation city that Jonathan was talking about. So that's on the one hand, the kind of material ecological change that shifts in cities and urban areas that become part of this kind of planetary urbanization process of corridorization. But then there is also the exclusion part of it. Who is excluded and included in this kind of corridor process? Across Northeast India, you see people being evicted. We've written a paper with Prerana Das and Gaurav Mittal about this, looking at all of these Northeast Indian cities that have been converted into these corridor cities that create forms of what we call entangled exclusions. Who are the people excluded out of these urban material processes when these corridor and gateway imaginations come to the fore? It's mostly the people who have been bordered as others in these areas. This could be different in different areas in the world, but essentially it's oftentimes something that has been constructed by the majoritarian populations living in these places as people who ought to not be part of the urban space, whether it's migrants, whether it's refugees, whether it's people who are not part of citizenship registers and so on. So you have ecological devastation, you have exclusions of people. And then finally, you have disruptions across, you know, I work in the war context in Myanmar, where, you know, you've had a coup since 2021. And in this coup, a lot of the areas that were originally imagined, like I said, as corridors or, you know, the China-Myanmar Economic Cooperation, SEZs, the special economic zones, you had big border gates, you had border cities that was originally controlled by both Chinese finances as well as Myanmar military. And those have been retaken by ethnic armed organizations or paramilitary forces or militias. And oftentimes when I interview them, they say, why is it that you have taken over the corridors, the zones of infrastructure or connectivity? And they often tell me it is because we will show them what they don't see. We will show them that by attacking critical infrastructures, by attacking the spaces through which extraction takes place, we're going to show the little violences that have accumulated over what has actually resulted in an ethnocide across the borders of Myanmar and a genocide on its western border with the Rohingya population. These are the violences that we are going to, visibilize against the spectacle of infrastructures, against the spectacle of corridors. So in a sense, we can also think about them as anti-spectacular disruptions against the spectacle of corridors. Again, these are the three ways that I thought of, but I'm curious to hear about Lewis.
Thanks to both Justine and John. Those were very, very interesting and inspiring interventions. I guess I'd like to start the same place from where, you know, John started, this idea of, you know, returning to splintering urbanism, because it's actually something that is quite relevant from my own research and from what I've been observing in Mombasa in terms of the kind of projects that have been ongoing are clearly kind of their effects is to kind of produce these cities that are centered around what I would call logistics, you know, led urbanization, right? So the organization of urban space around the production of cities, of nodal cities that are connected to what, you know, Simon and Marvin used to call, you know, kind of the integration to global markets, etc. But I guess the question that I've been asking myself now is in terms of, and it's, you know, kind of the article I'm working on is, are we in a context where what we're seeing is that instead of trying to integrate cities, these logistics cities into kind of nebulous global markets, we're instead seeing an attempt to align them to specific connectivity strategies and what it means in terms of the growing influence of geopolitical agendas in cities. And of course, the response to that is not simple. It's never simple. And I mean, there's been, you know, very interesting work from, you know, John and some other colleagues about these trends we're seeing about the emergence of cities, you know, connected to the BRI, etc. And what I find interesting in Mombasa is what I'm seeing at least is potentially, you know, this kind of overlapping of contested, you know, kind of how this process is contested because you have different connectivity strategies that are overlapping, meaning not only, you know, Japan and its FYP, which has framed Mombasa as like a flagship city for its, or at least Mombasa Port as a flagship city for its connectivity strategies, but also the broader city of Mombasa. And then you have, you know, China's BRI, of course, which has no official map, but, you know, some of the maps that we see circulating, you also have Mombasa on it, which is, I think, quite interesting. And then you have regional connectivity agendas, you know, Kenya that is trying to kind of produce this, you know, a nodal city that connects seamlessly the Indian Ocean to landlocked countries, etc. So you have this kind of overlapping of different visions, different strategies, the kind of way that I think is quite interesting of, you know, approaching this on a first analysis, messy deconfigurations, you know, of different forms of territorialization of space, etc., is first of all going from the agency of, you know, of local actors, or at least national actors in Kenya. So what has driven Kenyan authorities to engage a multiplicity of different actors to develop different sections of their corridor? Because, you know, as I said, you have, you know, Japan in Mombasa, you have China on the railway, you have other actors, like, for example, the United States that is possibly developing a road connecting Mombasa to Nairobi. And one of the interesting theses that, you know, we talk about in the Second Cold War Observatory, this is this idea that what we are seeing more and more is, you know, in contrast to, for example, the First Cold War, where it was really about non-alignment for, you know, southern nations, and saying that, you know, we don't want to pick true sides between the competing hegemons. It would be instead a form of poly-alignment, right? So saying that in a context of, you know, very integrated, you know, economies globally, etc., it makes no sense to, you know, either pick a side or say we do not want to choose any side. Instead, we want to extend as many relations as possible with as many actors as possible to you know, kind of extract as much benefits as we can from different deals and, you know, kind of international relations. Scholars, we call that hedging, right? What I think is interesting is looking at what are the territorial configurations that are emerging from these kind of, you know, patchworked and interconnected overlapping forms of territorialization in specifically my context of study, which is Kenya. It's also, again, you know, as I was mentioning earlier about, you know, accounting for the people, right? So how do people in the city of Mombasa, in their everyday lives, you know, perceive these projects and their implementation and the forms of also exclusion that they create? Because one of the thing about, for example, the current development in SGR and the Mombasa Port is that they're effectively organizing a form of bypassing, right, of the kind of urban economies that existed before these projects were developed. This kind of classical, you know, formula of Simon and Marvin of, you know, connecting valued users and places, etc. There's rarely a case where, you know, users who are considered non-valued are going to stay idle and not do, you know, anything. So it's also about how, you know, do these excluded actors, you know, react to these processes and how do they contest them. And what I see in Mombasa is that you also have different strategies that are mobilized by, you know, urban dwellers. They may be, you know, court cases, they may be protests, they may be various means that are allowed to say, okay, we have a say in the way, you know, these connectivity strategies are unfolding, and we want to be included in the type of benefits that these projects are promising. One of the decisions that came, you know, after the completion of not only the standard gauge railway, but also of the Mombasa Port expansion project, was a regulation that enforced all cargo coming in from through the port of Mombasa to be hauled via the SGR, right? And so the problem is that this regulation meant that a certain number of logistics clearance facilities that are in Mombasa would be excluded from the cargo clearing business, basically. The result was obviously a public outcry in Mombasa against this regulation, because, you know, they were directly impacting, you know, urban economies. They were having this kind of chain ripple effects, because obviously, you know, cargo business is a very important thing in Mombasa. So if you take away these types of, you know, cargo clearing businesses, it's going to have, you know, important impacts in Mombasa. So one of the things that I try to demonstrate in the work I'm currently doing is how these protests, court cases, etc., eventually led to the cancellation of the directives, which is, I guess, a small victory, but still something that is quite noticeable in terms of saying that it is always also important to account for the agency of local actors in in reshaping how these processes unfold on the ground.
Thanks, Luis. I feel the last question has been addressed by you at different points today, but I would pose it in any case just to invite you to maybe have some final reflections on this. So what new spatial configurations emerged through these networks, through these corridor networks, through circulatory networks, through logistical networks? So let's start again with you, John.
Thank you. What's new indeed? I think hearing a little more about Kenya and Myanmar, one asks whether these infrastructures are just a reverberation of these age-old infrastructures of empire, is extractive and technologies of dispossession, or whether there is something new. Reflecting on the question is really important, and maybe the answer that comes to mind for me is really an intensification and an acceleration. Intensification in that these networks are becoming more and more pronounced across the planet. In the work that we've been doing on the Corridor Atlas, we've been looking at around 70 new or well-established corridors, and the surge of investment since 2008, we have at about $1.6 trillion. So there's clearly some kind of intensification. But I also think there's another form of intensification, which is the violence that comes along with these infrastructures. We see how plans for the Gaza Riviera have been aligned with the India-Middle East economic corridor, and the whole kind of humanity is erased, the whole population is erased. And what we have are these plans for logistical circulation that can be 2 days faster than the next corridor over. I think the speed and intensity of these corridors precipitate massive spatial transformation at a planetary level in ways that demand our attention. When we think about how corridors are being deployed, they come with the promise not of one new special economic zone, but of 9 or 13 or even more. When we think of a new railway opening up an extractive frontier, is actually to connect to 3, 4, 5 different mining operations. With this intensification comes a new kind of spatial configuration, which may or may not be a planetary geography of corridors that also act as conduits for new forms of urbanization and economic life. But I think that's a question that remains open and really worth revisiting. Longer histories of infrastructure and corridors, particularly in the majority world, and the ways that they shaped nations such as Kenya.
Thanks. Thanks, John. Jasnia, do you want to go next, maybe?
Yeah, thank you. What's new? Again, whether we like it or not, we live in an era of war or wars. So in the context of Myanmar and in this world of war that we live in, a certain new configuration that has started across and beyond what used to be earlier choke points or SEZs and so on, is that the entire warscape or the war situation changes what corridors are, first of all, because you have multiple new actors, multiple new fragmentations, multiple new forms of territory making. And especially now in Myanmar, after the war, you don't just have those old-time kind of logistical corridors that we were writing about up until 2021, which used to be kind of the cross-border corridors or the ports and so on. Now you have one of the largest, most checkpointed nations in the world, where you have PDFs, People's Defense Forces, who are fighting against the Myanmar military, have their own logistical corridors, have their own roads, have their own checkpoints. Similarly, you have certain militias, then there's been just this kind of complete fragmentation of space, of territory, of local regions that creates very different configurations for local civilians who have to now navigate through these new forms of logistics. So what does war mean, or the age of war mean, in terms of these corridors, is a question that I think we can think about collectively in the future, because that's absolutely changed the way, in an age of hyperinflation and wars, how people access roads, or be able to even go to the next hospital or the school and so on, because they have to go through so many forms of extortions to so many multiple different actors who are constantly in a state of flux. So that's something that I have seen change in the context of Myanmar with war that's going on. And secondly, and lastly, maybe even the definitions of corridors and logistics could be expanded to think about, you know, we've talked about the multiverse of infrastructure, you know, the different forms of infrastructure. I've written about plantations or banana plantations as part of logistical infrastructures, which you can read up later on. But why do I say this? It's because so many multiple things that are connected in some way or another to extraction, in fact, does become part of corridors, even though we don't necessarily map it as such or call it as such. And maybe thinking through that could be another sort of future direction.
Thanks. Louise, do you want to go next?
Yeah, two very important questions. I personally don't think I have enough elements to kind of, you know, take on the question that Jasnia just mentioned about, you know, how do we navigate the current situation of, you know, of war and what it means in terms of thinking through logistics. But I find that the question also, you know, raised by John is, in terms at least of my case, that's significant because there are indeed continuities that we see between the current situation and the kind of coloniality of the way territorial patterns of spatial development have been designed since the colonial era. So I think indeed that to ask the question of the new, you first have to see what is persisting, what is the old that persists until now, but at the same time, recognizing those you know, persisting patterns of colonial forms of spatial development. What is particularly striking for me is, especially in the Kenyan case, there is forms of constant negotiation, contestation, reframing, you know, various form of agency of, you know, from the, you know, everyday urban dweller to more powerful political actors involved in continuously redefining how urban spaces develop, how kind of logistics are deployed throughout the territory in a context, Kenya, which since the colonial era has been, you know, kind of defined by this fundamental concern with logistics, right? So the connection between Mombasa and the hinterland has been a kind of foundational aspect of the very emergence of Kenya as a modern state, right? So inevitably, when we ask ourselves what is new, we have to take into account this history, but also the forms of, you know, ongoing negotiations and recombinations and contestation that reshape it.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Louis. Thanks, Jasnia, for this wonderful conversation. It was really amazing. I traveled to a lot of places. We learned a lot of new things. I'm sure that the listeners would write back to us. So join us in the next episode of this mini-series on urban political economies and geopolitical world-making, where we'll be joined by Yong Zhang, Sirma Altun, and Wojciech Kiblowski to bring yet another part of this bigger puzzle on cities and geopolitics for us. If you liked today's episode, please share it with your friends. Send us an email. We love receiving fan mail. If you have podcast ideas or would like to be involved, please do drop us an email as well.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.